Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast from Grace Anglican Church of Grove City, Pennsylvania. Our goal in every sermon is to proclaim the bold truth of the Word of God, especially the undiluted grace of Jesus Christ. If you want to learn more about our church, check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go.
There's a new dazzling article in The Spectator entitled, "A Christian Revival is Underway in Britain." The author writes these words: "Tom Holland recently invited me to attend a service of evensong with him at London's oldest church, St. Bartholomew the Great. Holland, who co-hosts the phenomenally popular The Rest is History podcast, has been a regular congregant for a few years now. Holland's book, Dominion, recounts how Holland, a secular liberal Westerner who had lost any vestige of faith by his teenage years, came to realize that he was essentially Christian in terms of his beliefs about human rights, equality, and freedom. Holland is not alone as an agnostic trying out church again. The congregation of St. Bart's mainly consists of young professionals. In fact, I noticed a famous politician among the faithful as well as a melancholy rock star. I believe Holland's journey reflects a wider turning of the secular tide in the West. The new atheists of the early 2000s, led by Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens, predicted a utopia founded upon science and reason once we had finally jettisoned religion. But what our post-Christian society has delivered instead of freedom is confusion, narcissism, a mental health crisis in the young, and the deepening of the culture wars. And so, the author concludes, a movement of new theists has sprung up." Makes a lot of sense to me. I was speaking 2 weeks ago with two young women who would have described themselves formerly as ex-evangelicals. Maybe you know the term. Ex-evangelical is when you grew up in a church, often a big box church, but within broad evangelicalism, and then for a variety of reasons, often to do with new social ethics, they back out and then begin to hate the church in which they were raised for a variety of either illegitimate or sometimes very legitimate reasons, but they back out. Well, I was talking to these two ex-evangelicals who have slowly re-entered the church. One is going to an Anglican church, the other is going to an Orthodox church. And I said, "Well, tell me why. I'm fascinated by the journey out, and I'm fascinated by the journey back." And one of them, who was cheekier than the other, said, "Well, you know, hedonism has a shelf life." Best line ever. Hedonism has a shelf life, meaning we tried it all. It got downright wild, downright perverse. We tried it all. And then they followed up with the comment, "You can only take so much Xanax." What they were saying is, you can only dull the pain so much with medicine and with aromatherapy and good napping and intermittent fasting. It's all great. But there's something about the soul that cries out for a little more than Xanax. I think they're brilliant. They came to the end of themselves and discovered that maybe after all of our deconstruction, all of our disassociation, all of our burning of the earth of our former lives, there was something underneath it all, something really true. And we didn't see it. But now we're beginning to see a little of it. I really like talking with them because I think we are quickening to something. After all the skepticism, cynicism, nihilism, narcissism, stupid culture wars, there remains a resilient fact, perhaps buried, forgotten, misunderstood, or misrepresented. And that fact is still true whenever the fog clears and the dust settles. And that foundational, unconquerable fact is the physical resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. That is the fact beneath all other facts. So I want to talk about Mark chapter 16 today, and I want to talk about the three facts of Jesus' resurrection as they are relayed by this story: the fact of stone, the fact of absence, and the fact of presence. So the fact of stone. I invite you to follow along. This begins in verse 1. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on, the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" We'll stop there. Now, this stone, of course, is literal. This is not a papier-mâché. It's like a two-ton pizza stone, a two-ton round pizza stone that they put in front of an opening to a cave. This was the way very wealthy people were buried. You may know that crucified victims were not placed in fancy graves. They were placed in large pits with other anonymous victims of execution or assassination. They were just dumped there. Or they were left on crosses to be devoured. Well, anyway, Jesus had a rich friend who let him borrow his rich person tomb, and so Jesus was placed within that tomb, and then a stone was rolled across the front of it. Jesus had touched another stone like this, a very similar stone, a week prior when his friend Lazarus was raised from the dead. And here he is in his own tomb. Well, these three women, these mourners, knew that they would have to deal with the big stone. They had hoped that, you know, maybe around this area there would be some strong blokes who would move it. But they approach the crypt. I want you to notice this. They approach the crypt of Christ without a molecule of hope. By this time, hope was as dead as Christ. And we see their disbelief displayed in their hands as well as their heads. In their hands, they carry pots of lotions and herbs to help mummify the corpse and to help prevent excessive odor during decomposition. This was a way that Jewish people, I want you to notice this, Jewish people cared about physicality. Even when somebody that you love died, you would take care of the dead body because Judaism didn't have antipathy for the physical form or for the image of God or for the body. So they wanted to tend to it and tend to it kindly and respectfully. But they're carrying these things because they anticipate a Jesus who is able to be mummified. But we also see disbelief in their heads because they're worried about, in verse 4, the large or two-ton stone. They know that they're going to go to a grave that will be sealed shut. They have no expectation of resurrection. Now, you may remember in Jesus' earthly ministry, there were several occasions in which he told his followers that he would both die and rise. But whenever you go through a traumatic event that takes your heart and makes it cloven in two, you tend to lose the hope. You tend to lose the positive prophecy. And so they have no expectation of resurrection. They stopped hoping. One of the saddest passages in all the New Testament is found in Luke 24, whenever Jesus, in a somewhat disguised way, the risen Jesus, is walking with two of his followers to Emmaus, a little town. And they say to Jesus, about Jesus, without knowing it was Jesus, "We had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel." Hope in the past tense. We had hoped. Meaning they're not hoping anymore. And neither are these women. The fact of the stone in this passage signifies something quite clear. Finality. A boxed canyon. Termination. Sartre's no exit. It means it's all over. The great man, the sage, the mystical healer, the intuitive exorcist, the brilliant professor was gone for good, and all that's left in the world now are sort of echoes of white magic, reverberations of what his life might have meant. A week earlier, Jesus' own apprentices thought that they would soon walk upon red carpets and sit upon cushioned thrones, and things were going to work out very well. And now it's all done. And it's all gone, like a dream that they woke up from. And so hope is as dead as Christ. And the stone is in some ways the last insult that underscores the finality. Now not only is Jesus dead, he's locked in a room. And I'm wondering, and I mean this metaphorically, of course, if you've ever had a stone-like experience where you've discovered within your life that there was some sort of terminus or no exit, no hopes for escape. No hopes for a better future, a better life. You know, I never knew when I signed up for ministry what I was going to get into. And the pain that I would have to face, not only because of my own mistakes, but also just the pain that people communicate to me of their own no exit, of their own locked-inness, of their own stuckness. I remember my first year of ministry, I was speaking with somebody in another church. It was two strugglers with suicidality in the same church. One was a 14-year-old girl that was bullied so severely that she became so stressed that her hair was all falling out. And as a 14-year-old, wanted to take her own life because she felt so stuck and dead inside. Another was a grad student, brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant. A young man who, because of a very serious mental health issue, was put into various hospitals and rehab centers. And he, at one point, after an attempt on his own life, called himself intractably defective. They experienced a tomb-like life, locked in a place with no light, no hope, no escape. And I'm wondering if you've ever had a tomb-like experience in that sense where you're totally without hope, that you've done everything you can do, and there's nothing more that can be done, and you're stuck. And if we haven't experienced that existentially, we will certainly all experience it in terms of our own mortality. There's a stone coming. We will be often buried under the ground with a stone placed above us that says terminus, finality, the end, no exit. Well, Jesus experienced that too. He had his own stone. And so we have to deal with the fact of the stone, the fact of the great terminus, the fact of the death of hope. But when God engages with the impossible all of a sudden becomes quite possible. And that's why we have the next fact, the fact of absence. So we're shifting from the fact of stone to the fact of absence. This is in verse 4. And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back, and it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. And he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." Now, every last one of the New Testament accounts of the resurrection conveys that the tomb was empty, that Jesus really died, was really buried, and really rose again. There was an empty tomb. Well, let's call it a semi-empty tomb. It wasn't perfectly empty, because while Jesus was absent, some sort of other figure was present. The other gospel accounts clue us in that this was an angel. Mark just says a man, and he's like the opposite of Johnny Cash, the man in black. He's the man in white. And he offers a wild explanation of the corpse's absence. Not he was stolen, not he lives in your heart. Instead, he's risen. That's why he's not here. He has risen. Now, that tiny little phrase contains a universe of meaning that I will now explain in two sentences. Within Judaism, there existed a budding hope, a growing hope within the Old Testament corpus. A growing hope that at the end of this age, God would resurrect, physically resurrect his people. It wasn't like Greek thought where your body wasted away and your soul left your body and that was the end of the story. And within Judaism, the idea was that God would restore your innards and your outwards, your inward self and your outward self, your spiritual self, your physical self, to make a unified self that was dynamically invincible, healthy, strong, and permanently so. That was the Jewish hope, because God made creation good. God's going to restore his good creation, and the resurrection of man is part of that good restoration. But the Jews all expected that that would happen at the end of the age. They didn't expect that in the middle of this age of decay and terror and doubt, that somebody would be resurrected, never to die again. That God would ultimately vindicate his Messiah by raising him from the dead in this historic way. And so when he says he is risen, That word risen has a lot of connotations within Judaism, that the grand restoration project is officially begun. It's all starting now. And so this is the New Testament conviction. It is the universal conviction of the New Testament that Jesus, the real historic Jesus, physically, tangibly, historically, rose again and vacated the tomb. We have a fact of absence. The same Jesus that ate apricots and shopped for clothes and smiled and yelled and worked 22 years as a contractor and said things and did things that no one else could do or say, that Jesus who bled out and died on a real Roman cross is now absent from a real borrowed tomb. And everything hinges upon this point in Christianity. This is why in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul can write so convincedly, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is in vain and you're still in your sins, and we are of all people most to be pitied. But in fact, Christ has been raised. So I'm wondering if we can handle the fact of absence, the vacant tomb, that the former occupant had really died, was really placed there, and now the tomb was hollowed out. You may know the name Jordan Peterson. He's a psychoanalyst from Canada, a somewhat controversial figure, though I like a lot of what he says. I think he's a pretty helpful pushback against some of the most bizarre ideas in culture. But he's never really publicly grappled very well with the idea of Jesus' resurrection, unless I'm missing a more recent conversation. He finds the idea of Jesus' resurrection to be psychologically satisfying. Because he says, it symbolizes the parts of us that need to die and need to rise again. That's my best Albertan accent, by the way. And that's the best he can come up with. Isn't it wonderful that we have a symbol, a metaphor of new beginnings for our own experience? I totally agree. We need those. Great. I believe in restarts. It's just not enough, though. It's not enough. Metaphor is not enough. Let us not mock God with metaphor, sidestepping, transcendence, making of the event a parable. Because that was never the claim. Never the claim. Instead, we believe in something more wild, more destabilizing. That something actually happened. That sometimes the metaphor, so to speak, is so real that it becomes tangible and alters the course of the human story, of the universal story. I think sometimes we want the tomb occupied. We're fine with Jesus rising, as long as he does so rather mystically, that he rises in our intelligence by giving us new ideas that live on, or in our hearts, in our sentimentality, that his love lives within us, or in nature. He's like the butterflies that come back in the spring. Those are all great images that point to something else, namely that something did happen. Something happened. That's the universal claim, that the tomb was in fact empty, emptied of its occupant. That's the fact of the stone, the fact of absence, and now the fact of presence. Verse 7, but go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. Not just hear about him, not feel him in your heart or think about his treasured memory, but instead you will see him. What's fascinating about Mark's gospel is it includes no resurrection scenes where Jesus himself shows up. There's a promise that people will see, but then no recounting of those individual or corporate conversations with him, engagements with him. Other gospels do that. They display Jesus cooking and eating fish, appearing to doubting Thomas, inviting Thomas to touch his broken skin, showing up to those Emmaus travelers, and later, according to Paul, over 500 people saw him alive. Mark's gospel makes it all a matter of the future, that he will be with his disciples in Galilee. Why Galilee? Because it's home. It's where they all grew up. It's their old stomping ground. It's where they, you know, learned to walk and went on dates and got jobs and eventually where they met Jesus. You know, it's like Grove City. It's like Jesus saying, I will meet you in the Grove. I'll meet you in the Grove City. Now, why I think that's remarkable and we ought not to miss it is how humble Jesus is even in his resurrection. If Okay, so I think it was a tactical error. I'm just saying, like going to Galilee, you could have gone to Jerusalem. Like I would have paid some visits. Be like, hi, Caiaphas. Pontius Pilate, you thought you were powerful. Herod, you like to play mind games with me. He could have displayed his power. He could have judged them on the spot, could have burned them up. He could have made quite a demonstration of his new powerful authority as the risen Lord of the world. And what does the risen Lord of the world do but go to Grove City? He goes to Galilee, a town nobody cares about, an area that was largely forgotten. Much of it wasn't even taxed by the Romans because they didn't care about it. And there is Jesus, the risen Lord of life, going to Galilee because that's where he first met the disciples. And so even in his resurrected state, we see the same humility that was part of his character before the resurrection ever happened. Well, those same disciples from the other gospel accounts, we know this, did see him. They not only saw, they like felt him. They had food with him. They had breakfast on a beach with him. And I want to point out, just as a matter of an apologia, that those same disciples, all of them, with the exception of John of Patmos, all of them died as martyrs. They died old men, beaten to death, crucified, stoned, stabbed, flayed alive. All of them died as martyrs, with the exception of John of Patmos. They tried to boil John in oil, but he didn't die. I don't know. And then they stuck him on an island called Patmos where he wrote the book of Revelation. And then they just let him die an old man on Patmos. Because if you can't boil somebody in oil, what can you do? You know? But they all died rather than deny Jesus' resurrection. That is a miracle. People say, oh, Ethan, who cares? Lots of religious zealots and nuts die for all sorts of causes. I'm like, yes, people will die for all sorts of causes that they believe are true. Nobody dies for a cause that they know they fabricate from the beginning, certainly not more than one person. That's never happened. I found this this little quippy description of the Watergate crisis from Chuck Colson. You may remember he got in trouble with the Nixonian Watergate crisis and then went to prison and then became a Christian and started a ministry to prisoners. This is what he wrote. I think it's brilliant. I know that the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. How? Because 12 men testified that they had seen Jesus raised from the dead, and then they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. Every one of them was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison. They would not have endured that if it weren't true. Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep alive for 3 weeks. You're telling me that 12 apostles could keep alive for 40 years? Absolutely impossible. So those are my three little points today. The fact of the stone, the fact of absence, and the fact of presence. They really had an encounter. And so today, I am not asking you to believe in a flat earth or the moral magnificence of the church or its clergy, a utopian vision, or one particular view of creationism, or if Christianity can save the West or the East. I'm not really interested. Instead, this is the central question of Christianity. Did Jesus really, truly rise again? Is it a fact? Well, I have an intelligent and highly skeptical friend named Todd, who often repeats a very bad mantra. So he lives in Lancaster, we occasionally get together, we love to debate, and he says, and this, okay, this was a very adult conversation, I am now going to make it very PG. Not even PG-13, PG. Todd says, this is his mantra, I have a very strong BS detector, a very strong BS detector, which leads him to be suspicious of everything and everyone, especially Christianity. Well, one night, after several vodka tonics, what a wimpy drink, Todd started picking on a new convert, a friend of ours who grew up kind of within an addicted home, became an alcoholic, and became a Christian within this Mennonite, this little country Mennonite church near Lebanon, Pennsylvania. But Todd, the skeptic, kept attacking him. We were playing cards, and Todd kept attacking him. The attacks were subtle at first. He said, you know, do you really know what you're doing? I'm just concerned that you have all the information, all the data, and you're making an informed choice when you join Christianity. But then, after a few drinks, they became more passive-aggressive. I just never thought of you as a naive person. And then they became more aggressive-aggressive, the comments. What you believe makes you an oppressor of the marginalized. And he kept saying this tired refrain, you know, I have too much of a BS detector to ever be a Christian. Well, after getting fed up with his repeated cynical critiques, but mostly I got tired of his bullying of my friend, I said, you know what, man? I think that your BS detector is BS. You play this role. This role is the safe cynic, always standing safely outside pretty much everything and then lobbing bombs at people that you say you like from this place of privileged skepticism because you believe in nothing. But that isn't really true, is it? You do believe in something. You certainly believe in something. You believe in your BS detector. That lame, spiteful, and by the way, highly subjective BS detector is your little god, a little deity that you believe will keep you safe from being duped or seen as naive or stupid, but please don't lie to yourself because you do worship something. You worship at the altar of your own fear and doubt. I wasn't nice, but I was clear. Well, it was interesting because normally he likes to fight back, but he didn't fight back. He all of a sudden got sort of white, and he said, well, and he was embarrassed and I think a little mad, but he said, well, fine. I mean, then why don't you explain to me? Why don't you explain to me what you really believe? And I said, I believe in grace. At the center of this whole enterprise, it's like love comes to us, but not because we have the right accumulations or the right adjustments or we've made our intellect more finely tuned or our life goals all worked out. I think love wraps around us at our lowest place. In our denial, when we hate ourselves, when we can't get out of bed anymore, even if we never get better. That's when love comes to us, that forgiveness runs toward us and claims us before we know how to make heads or tails of it. And I said, and I think that's all true because of the resurrection of Jesus. It's not just an idea or some amoebic thought. The resurrection vindicates everything that Jesus believed, everything that he ever was, all of his flow, his beauty, his outlandish compassion, everything he taught about God. The resurrection is how we know grace is real. That's what I think. It was sweet. He responded. He was laughing a little. He's like, well, that's new. He hadn't heard that before. He said, that grace idea doesn't sound like BS to me. And I responded, good, then you'll be professing the Nicene Creed in no time. And you know what's great? He is right now. Yeah. Our wild claim is that Jesus' resurrection is an inconvenient, weird, gritty, earthy, oxygen-breathing, skin and bone fact of history. And the fact of resurrection is more certain than all other facts, because unlike all other facts, the resurrected Jesus doesn't die again. All other facts will. The sun and the solar system will. The earth will. America will. He won't. That fact is stronger than your facts. That fact is stronger than your leukemia, stronger than your anorexia. Stronger than your divorce, stronger than your withering relationships, stronger than your regret, stronger than your doubt, stronger even than your death. Because Jesus' resurrection is a fact, here's another fun fact. You'll be raised too. That's what he promised. That his resurrection would not be an isolated event, but would just get the ball rolling. In the end, you recover fully and gorgeously so. and you'll see the people you love again. Because sometimes the wildest stories turn out to be true. Prodigiously, stubbornly, factually true for all time. Amen.
Free at last, they took your life. They could not take your breath.